From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
What myself and other people like myself are trying to get at is that September 11th was either a case of criminal negligence on the part of our government or direct involvement in the attacks.
At Popular Mechanics, we think that facts matter. And we were intrigued by the questions that the conspiracy community was raising, thought somebody should check them out, really dig in, do some real reporting, and see if there's any grain of truth to any of these things. And if so, then we would wholeheartedly support much deeper investigation, more work. But in fact, every time we looked at one of the facts raised by the conspiracy community, they simply didn't hold up.
September 11th, 2001. 5 years after the attacks, many people are asking questions about what happened on that day in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. We'll talk about some of the theories with the filmmakers of Loose Change and the editors of Popular Mechanics, that's put out a book debunking 9/11 myths. Today, a 9/11 national broadcast exclusive, the first televised debate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Memorials are being held across the country today to mark the fifth anniversary of 9/11. In New York, moments of silence are planned at the World Trade Center site at the times when jetliners struck each of the Twin Towers and when each tower fell. Spouses and partners of the 2,749 who died at the Trade Center are planning to read the names of each victim. Last night's lights filled the sky in Washington, D.C. The light display was made up of 184 beams, each one representing a life lost at the Pentagon. President Bush visited Ground Zero Sunday. Today he's planning to visit the Pentagon and Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where 40 people were killed when a jet crashed into the ground. The president's scheduled to address the nation tonight. As the country marks the anniversary of 9/11, the Washington Post reports the hunt for Osama bin Laden has gone stone cold. The newspaper says the U.S. government hasn't received a credible lead on his whereabouts in more than 2 years. In March 2002, President Bush decided to pull out most of the troops leading the hunt for bin Laden in Afghanistan to prepare for war in Iraq. The Bush administration still has no one official in charge of the overall hunt for bin Laden. Pakistan has reportedly all but stopped looking for him. In other news from Afghanistan, a provincial governor was killed by a suicide car bomber on Sunday. Hakeem Taniwal is the highest-ranking official to be killed since the Taliban insurgency began. Taniwal was a close friend of Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The bombing came 2 days after a suicide car bombing in Kabul killed 14 Afghan civilians and two American soldiers. The chief of intelligence for the Marine Corps in Iraq has concluded the U.S. military has been all but defeated in the country's western province of Anbar. The Washington Post reports the classified assessment of the dire state of Anbar marks the first time that a senior U.S. military officer has filed such a negative report from Iraq. The Marine report concluded there are no functioning Iraqi government institutions in Anbar, which includes the cities of Ramadi, Fallujah, and Haditha. Al-Qaeda in Iraq has become the most significant political force in the province. The McClatchy newspapers have revealed U.S. officials are attempting to downplay the level of violence by Iraq by undercutting the number of Iraqis killed. A U.S. military spokesperson confirmed the military no longer includes deaths from car bombings or mortar attacks as victims of the country's sectarian violence. That's allowed U.S. officials to boast the number of deaths from sectarian violence in Baghdad declined by more than 52% in August over July. Earlier today, 14 new Iraqi army recruits died after their minibus was blown up in Baghdad by a suicide car bomber. Here in this country, the Senate Intelligence Committee released a major report Friday that concluded there's no relationship between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, despite such claims by the Bush administration. The report stated, quote, Saddam Hussein was distrustful of al-Qaeda and viewed Islamic extremists as a threat to his regime, refusing all requests from al-Qaeda to provide material or operational support. Democratic Senator John Rockefeller.
During the buildup to war, the intelligence community was placed under pressure, Mr. President, to support the administration's position that there was a link between Iraq and al-Qaeda. This is particularly distressing.
The Senate report also disclosed for the first time the CIA had concluded Saddam's government did not have a relationship, harbor, or turn a blind eye toward al-Qaeda operative Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. In fact, Hussein tried to have Zarqawi captured once he moved to northern Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney raised the Zarqawi link during an interview Sunday on NBC's Meet the Press with Tim Russert.
So you've got Iraq and 9/11, no evidence that there's a connection. You've got Iraq and al-Qaeda, testimony from the director of CIA that there was indeed a relationship. Zarqawi in Baghdad, etc. Then the third
committee said that there was no relationship. In fact, Saddam.
I haven't seen the report. I haven't had a chance to read it yet.
But Mr. Vice President, the bottom line is
we know that Zarqawi, running a terrorist camp in Afghanistan prior to 9/11, after we went into 9/11, then fled and went to Baghdad and set up operations in Baghdad in the spring of 2002, and was there from then basically until the time we launched into Iraq.
Vice President Dick Cheney being questioned by Tim Russert on Meet the Press. The Senate Intelligence Committee also released a report confirming the U.S.-funded Iraqi National Congress fed the U.S. government and media false information that was later used as the basis of pre-war intelligence reports. Intelligence officials repeatedly warned the INC was unreliable and that it had been penetrated by Iranian spies. Human rights officials in Gaza are warning that the 10-week-old Israeli siege has created widespread suffering and mass despair. Journalist Patrick Coburn writes in The Independent of London, quote, "Gaza is dying. The Israeli siege of the Palestinian enclave is so tight that its people are on the edge of starvation. A whole society is being destroyed," Coburn writes. The United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees has announced it's increased the amount of food aid to refugees in Gaza for the first time in 5 years. Israel continues to carry out military attacks in Gaza and the West Bank. On Sunday, an Israeli tank shell killed a 14-year-old boy in the town of Rafah. A 19-year-old relative of the boy was also injured. Meanwhile, in the West Bank town of Jenin, undercover Israeli forces shot and killed a Palestinian man earlier today. Protesters are gathering in Beirut today to greet British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Lebanon's most senior Shiite cleric tried to have Blair's visit canceled. Grand Ayatollah Mohammed Hussein Fadlala accused Blair of contributing to, quote, killing us and slaughtering our children. Meanwhile, the Israeli military has revealed it fired an estimated 237,000 artillery shells during its attack on Lebanon. Over the weekend, the Israeli military was accused of breaking the month-old ceasefire after it detained 5 Lebanese civilians in southern Lebanon. This is Alexander Ivanko, a spokesperson for the United Nations Interim Forces in Lebanon.
It is a violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement, and that's why we got involved straight away. And this is not the first time this has happened. And in all these cases, we have secured the release of all the people who have been detained by the Israeli Defense Forces since the cessation of agreement was signed on the 14th of August. So we have succeeded in securing the release of all the people, including the last 5.
In Israel, up to 40,000 protesters gathered in Tel Aviv Saturday to demand the Israeli government authorize a state inquiry to probe the handling of the war in Lebanon. The demonstration was the largest public show of dissatisfaction with Prime Minister Ehud Olmert since he took office in May. This is one of the protesters, Yuval Cohen.
We're gathering here to demand a constitutional inquiry of what happened in the Lebanon war. And I'm here because, like many other Israelis, we don't think Israel can compromise on its security.
Back in the United States, at least 10 Florida journalists have been caught taking payments from the U.S. government. 3 of the reporters worked for the Miami Herald or its sister publication, El Nuevo Herald. The payments totaled hundreds of thousands of dollars. All the journalists receive money for doing work on the U.S. government-run stations Radio Marti and TV Marti. The government beams the anti-Castro stations into Cuba, but its broadcasts are prohibited in this country due to laws that prohibit the government from broadcasting propaganda inside the United States. The Cuban government has long alleged U.S. journalists covering Cuba were on the government payroll. A British human rights group has accused the Bush administration of continuing to secretly hold prisoners in overseas prisons. Last week, President Bush announced 14 prisoners being held in secret CIA prisons would be transferred to Guantanamo. during a speech. Bush said there are now no terrorists in the CIA program. However, the British group Reprieve says the whereabouts of dozens of detained suspects remain unknown. The group's legal director, Clive Stafford Smith, said the Bush administration is holding several hundred detainees at the Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, none of whom has been named by the Pentagon. The Washington Post reports a growing number of CIA counterterrorism officers are signing up for private insurance plans that would pay their civil judgments and legal expenses if they're sued or charged with criminal wrongdoing. Many CIA officers are concerned they could be sued for being involved in abuse, torture, human rights violations, and other misconduct. The Sudanese government has released Chicago Tribune reporter Paul Salopek after holding him for 5 weeks. Sudan had accused the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist of being a spy. After his release, Salopek spoke with reporters.
If I were to be granted a visa, I would absolutely come back to Sudan. It's an extremely important country.
In other news from Africa, the Observer newspaper of London reports evidence has emerged that America is involved in illegal mercenary operations in Somalia. The newspaper says it's obtained leaked emails that suggest the CIA had knowledge of plans to run covert military operations inside Somalia against UN rulings. The U.S. mercenary company involved has been identified as Select Armor, a firm based in Virginia. The UN's Emergency Relief Coordinator, Jan Egeland, has traveled to the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's warned the UN is running out of money to feed the country's 1.7 million displaced people.
This is the epicenter, really, of the humanitarian tragedy of the Congo, perhaps the worst in the world for this last decade. These women and children have been abused, have been raped, have lost everything. Some humanitarian assistance is now coming for the first time to this area to really help them. Our hope is from the UN to massively increase assistance and more than anything help them provide the peace in this area so they can return to their fertile land.
The UN's Jan Egeland. On Sunday, ABC aired part one of its controversial made-for-TV movie, The Path to 9/11, despite strong criticism that the producers fabricated key scenes. In one part, President Clinton's national security advisor, Sandy Berger, is seen as refusing authorization for a proposed raid to capture Osama bin Laden in spring of 1998. The film alleges CIA operatives in Afghanistan had bin Laden in their sights at the time. According to the 9/11 Commission, CIA operatives were never poised to carry out such an attack. Two retired FBI agents have admitted they rejected advisory roles on the miniseries because of concerns about the program's accuracy. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 5 years ago today, nearly 3,000 people were killed in the attacks on September 11, 2001. Ceremonies are set to take place today in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, elsewhere around the country to remember those killed. President Bush launched the anniversary event Sunday in New York by visiting Ground Zero, where the twin towers of the World Trade Center once stood. Millions of people across the U.S. are planning vigils, walks, and other commemorations to remember that fateful morning. We begin today's coverage by going back to September 11, 2001. Broadcasting for over 6 hours, Democracy Now! Covered the attacks just blocks from Ground Zero. This is an excerpt of our radio broadcast from the firehouse on 9/11.
The latest news we have is that there have been widespread attacks that include at least three commercial jet crashes. We now believe perhaps four. Three commercial jet crashes into significant buildings. In the first attack, a plane hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in Manhattan shortly before 9 o'clock, followed by another plane into the second tower about 20 minutes later. Both towers later collapsed. About an hour later, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, part of which later collapsed. American Airlines told CNN that it lost two planes in tragic accidents. Flight 11 from Boston with 81 passengers and 11 crew aboard, and Flight 77 from Washington Dulles Airport with 58 passengers and 6 crew aboard. Both planes were en route to Los Angeles. United Airlines Flight 93 airliner headed from Newark, New Jersey to San Francisco crashed near Somerset, Pennsylvania. Police said initial reports indicated no survivors. It was not known if this was connected to the attacks. United also said it was deeply concerned about Flight 175 from Boston to Los Angeles. The Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, the Justice Department, the Capitol, the CIA, and all other government buildings in Washington have been evacuated. President Bush canceled an appearance in Florida to return to Washington, calling the crashes, quote, apparent terrorist attacks and, quote, a national tragedy. In the first ever national ground stop of aircraft, all flights nationwide have been stopped at their departure airports. All international flights were diverted to Canada. In New York, more than 10,000 rescue personnel have rushed to the scene. The entire downtown area of Manhattan, the mayor has recommended people evacuate, though we are in that area, and certainly so are hundreds of thousands of other people. Israel has evacuated all its missions around the world. In Chicago, the Sears Tower was evacuated. The United Nations in New York has been evacuated. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta was evacuated. CDC was preparing bioterrorism teams in case they become necessary. The New York Port Authority says it has closed all bridges and tunnels into the city. Today is primary day in New York. These elections have been canceled.
An excerpt of our Democracy Now! Broadcast, September 11th, 2001, as we continue our coverage today on this fifth anniversary of the attacks. Last week, we heard from New Yorkers calling on the federal government to stop ignoring the health effects of the attacks on the World Trade Center. A major new study of 9/11 finds nearly 7 out of every 10 first responders at Ground Zero now suffer from chronic lung ailments. We also spoke with a man whose brother was killed at the World Trade Center, is now spearheading a movement against President Bush's war on terror. And we looked at September 11th, 100 years ago, when Gandhi launched Satyagraha, the modern nonviolent resistance movement that continues to this day. Well, today we bring you a national exclusive, a debate about 9/11. Ever since the attacks took place, many people across the country have raised a number of questions about what actually happened on that day in New York, Washington, and Pennsylvania. Websites, articles, books, and documentaries have put forward a variety of alternate theories to the government's account of what happened. The most popular of these is a documentary called Loose Change. The 80-minute film first appeared on the web April 2005. Since then, it's had at least 10 million viewings and is described by Vanity Fair as the first internet blockbuster. As the popularity of Loose Change has soared, a book dealing with the questions it and others have raised about 9/11 has been published. It's called Debunking 9/11 Myths, Why Conspiracy Theories Can't Stand Up to the Facts. It's put together by the editors of the magazine Popular Mechanics. So today we'll talk about some of the theories and the arguments against them. We're joined in our studio by the filmmakers of Loose Change. Dylan Avery is the writer and director of the film, and Jason Burmis is the film's researcher. From Popular Mechanics, we're joined by David Dunbar, the executive editor of the magazine. He led the editorial team that produced Debunking 9/11 Myths. James Meggs is also with us, the magazine's editor-in-chief. Before we go to all of them, let's go to a clip of Loose Change that deals with the attacks on the Pentagon on 9/11.
10:06 a.m., Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Flight 93 was en route from Newark, New Jersey to California with 45 passengers when it went off course at 8:56 over northeastern Ohio. According to the official story, Flight 93 was en route to Washington, D.C. when it was overpowered by a group of passengers and crashed into an abandoned strip mine in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Out of all the events of 9/11, the one that has caused the most confusion is Flight 93. It was shot down, it wasn't shot down. However, evidence suggests that perhaps Flight 93 was nowhere near Shanksville.
Last hour, I want to get quickly to Chris Kanicki. He's a photographer with the Pittsburgh affiliate, a Fox affiliate. He was back there just a couple of minutes ago, and Chris, I've seen the pictures. It looks like there's nothing there except for a hole in the ground.
Basically, that's right. The only thing you could see from where we were was a big gouge in the earth and some broken trees. We could see some people walking around in the area, but From where we could see, there wasn't much left.
Any large pieces of debris at all?
No, there was nothing that you could distinguish that a plane had crashed there.
Smoke, fire?
Nothing. It was absolutely quiet. It was actually very quiet. Nothing going on down there, no smoke, no fire. Just a couple of people walking around. They look like part of the NTSB crew walking around looking at the pieces.
How big would you say that hole was?
From my estimates, I would guess it was probably about 20 to 15 feet long and probably about 10 feet long or 10 feet wide.
What could you see on the ground, if anything, other than dirt and ash? And
you couldn't see anything. You could just see dirt, ash, and people walking around broken.
Wally Miller, a Somerset County coroner. It looked like somebody just dropped a bunch of metal out of the sky. In the Washington Post, it looked like someone took a scrap truck, dug a 10-foot ditch, and dumped trash into it. And as for the passengers, I stopped being coroner after about 20 minutes because there were no bodies there. In the Pittsburgh Review, I have not, to this day, seen a single drop of blood. Not a drop. It would seem that on one day, for the second time in history, an entire plane, along with its passengers, disappeared upon impact.
An excerpt of Loose Change. We'll talk with the filmmakers as well as the editors of Popular Mechanics when we come back from break, and then we'll take on the issue of what happened in Washington, the question of what hit the Pentagon. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 500 stations around the country on Pacifica and NPR and PBS and public access TV stations on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we take on the issue of what happened on September 11, 2001, our guests are Dylan Avery, writer and director of Loose Change, Jason Burmis, researcher for the film. James Meggs is also with us, editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics, and David Dunbar, executive editor of Popular Mechanics, who led the editorial team that produced the book, Debunking 9/11 Myths. Jim Meggs, you're the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics. Your response to this excerpt of Loose Change about what happened in Shanksville?
You know, that clip is really interesting because it shows how slickly made this film is, how compelling it is at asking a series of sort of hanging questions and putting some spooky music behind it and making it sound as if someone's covering up these facts, but a brave researcher can dig down and put all the pieces together. In fact, there's answers to all those questions. If you look at the sources that were used throughout that clip, they're all things that came up in the first day or two after the attacks. In some cases, somebody standing across a field and saying, I don't see a plane. Well, when a plane strikes the ground at over 500 miles an hour flying almost straight down, there typically isn't much visible above ground. They also quote the coroner in the Shanksville area, we talked to the coroner. He had the horrific job of collecting the body parts and cataloging and performing all the necessary tests. Those bodies were identified, the plane wreckage in the pieces, the tiny pieces that it was in after it hit the ground was you know, collected from the hole, cataloged, and the black box was recovered, and we know what went on because of the records of the voice cockpit recorder, and in this case, quite a few phone calls from the aircraft itself to various people on the ground. So we know a lot of what happened in Flight 93. The film is alleging that no plane crashed there at all. The people were sent off somewhere to somehow be disposed of. If you're going to allege something so far beyond what a huge body of evidence would suggest is the truth, then you do need to pull together some evidence. And so we fully support asking questions and being skeptical. But if you're going to ask questions, you also have to look for the answers. And when you get answers, you can't ignore them.
James Burmis of Loose Change.
I'd just like to thank you for the opportunity to take on the government's lies and Popular Mechanics, which is a Hearst Yellow Journalism publication's lies as well. And I would just say, look for yourself. This is an open field, and for the first time in history, we have a crater and no plane debris. Look at any other plane crash, and you'll find a tail section, a wing section. There were reports that this actually was strewn out over 8 miles, and we have videotape of smaller pieces of debris. The coroner speaks for himself. We have the Pittsburgh Gazette, the editor-in-chief there, saying, again, there's nothing there that looks like a plane. Again, don't believe us. Go to seeloosechange.com right now and watch it for free. But take a look. All those people, you would normally have NTSB people in blue jackets to get the plane parts and put them back together. That's what happened with TWA 800 that was in the ocean. And you don't have that. You have people in hazmat uniforms. Why? So all we're saying is, look, there's no plane in this open field at all. There's a 10-foot crater by 16-foot, and there's just smoke there. So where is this plane? That's all we're saying.
What about what the coroner said, collecting body parts?
Well, he's never addressed us, and if you look at all of his media accounts in the days after when he was first asked, again, he said there were no body parts, and to this day, he has not seen a single drop of blood. So again, I would say that's more reliable than, you know, 4 years after the fact being contacted.
Did you talk to him?
He won't address us. Basically, we have had people contact him, and he hangs up on us.
I find, typically, when we investigate these things, it's very easy to find public records, to find the reports from all the various agencies that have investigated these accidents. The transcripts of the voice cockpit recorder have been released. In many cases, again, the sources, Jason, those are all newspaper articles are written the day of, day after, a couple of days after.
No, one you of know them was what, a year after the fact.
You know what it was like on those days, and you know how chaotic it was. You know how much misinformation typically comes out in the early hours of a major news event. Over time, with further research and good reporting, you can sift through those things, and you can make progress in getting to the truth. Typically, we see on conspiracy websites is citations that go back to the earliest moments when the least information was available, and virtually no reference to the voluminous research which is done to follow up.
Dylan, what about the issue of cell phones?
The issue of cell phones is that for a majority of Flight 93's flight, it was flying over cruising altitude, and a number of these, now, a majority of the phone calls were coming from air phones, but the cell phone calls were coming from cruising altitude. Now, it is pretty much impossible in 2001 to sustain an extended conversation over a cell phone at cruising altitude from a commercial airliner. But I mean, that's not our strongest evidence. I mean, that's just one of the many things about that day that don't add up to us. And we haven't gotten to hear the cockpit voice recorder. We haven't gotten to hear any of these alleged phone calls. I mean, the government is cherry picking the evidence that it releases to the government. And I feel that if our government was truly attacked by surprise and we had absolutely no inclination in the attacks, they would not be so reticent to release the 84 videos from the Pentagon, the cockpit voice recorder of Flight 93. The list of things that the government is holding from us goes on.
David Dunbar.
With regard to the cell phones, we did what any reporter would do. We talked to experts in the field, and in fact, cell phones do work at that altitude, up to 35,000 feet and higher. And
In 2001.
And it might be instructive for you to talk to some of the cell phone experts. There are a lot of drop calls because the plane is moving at high speed and the handoffs sometimes get dropped. That's true. And we know from the public record that, in fact, a lot of the cell phone calls were cut off. And most of the phone calls were made from the air phones. But nevertheless, talk to the experts and you'll find out that you can make a cell phone call from a commercial plane.
If I may address that for one moment, if that's true, then why in 2004 did American Airlines spend tens of thousands of dollars to put cell phone towers in their planes so people could make those calls? Why spend tens of thousands of dollars 3 years after the fact if they worked so well on September 11th? What he's saying is a total lie.
James Mix.
We didn't say they worked well, we said they worked. And if you look at the record, many of the calls were dropped, they were incomplete. But especially over rural areas, you know, if you think about it, a cell phone tower covers can cover a couple hundred square miles. That coverage area goes up into the sky as well as horizontally across the ground.
The reason
that they improved the system was to avoid the drop calls and to isolate the cell phone transmissions from any possible interference with the avionics.
Well, we're not going to cover any issue comprehensively, but we have a lot of issues to cover. And I'd like to turn now to
the cell phone is a weak argument.
Why do you say that?
Oh, I mean, it's not our best evidence. I mean, there's tons of things we could discuss besides the cell
phone.
Just
the fact the plane is not there, I think, is our best evidence. Well, and anyone can see that.
Let's turn to the Pentagon right now.
Sure.
In the excerpt of Loose Change that deals with the attack on the Pentagon.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon. The only site is the actual side of the building that's crashed in, and as I said, the only pieces left that you can see are small enough that you could pick up in your hand. There are no large tail sections, wing sections, a fuselage, nothing like that anywhere around, which would indicate that the entire plane crashed into the side of the Pentagon.
The official explanation is that the intense heat from the jet fuel vaporized the entire plane. Indeed. From these pictures, it seems that there's absolutely no trace of a fully loaded Boeing 757. But if the fire was hot enough to incinerate a jumbo jet, then how could investigators identify 184 out of 189 people found at the Pentagon? The Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory, which was responsible for the task, was also responsible for identifying the dead in Shanksville. Keep that in mind for later. So what is a Boeing 757 made of? The exact details are not public knowledge. But what we do know is that Flight 77 had two Rolls-Royce RB211 engines made of steel and titanium alloy, which are 9 feet in diameter, 12 feet long, and weigh 6 tons each. Titanium has a melting point of 1,688 degrees Celsius. Jet fuel is a hydrocarbon, which can maintain a constant temperature of 1,120 degrees Celsius after 40 minutes, but only if the fuel source is maintained. The fuel would have burned off immediately upon impact. Therefore, it is scientifically impossible that 12 tons of steel and titanium was vaporized by jet fuel.
Dylan Avery, the narrator and filmmaker of Loose Change, a film that is getting tremendous attention. Millions of people have downloaded it. Dylan and Jason are here in New York in this weekend of the anniversary, giving out thousands of copies of the film. The issue of the Pentagon, David Dunbar, executive editor of Popular Mechanics.
Well, the clip starts with a red herring, claiming that experts say the plane was vaporized, which is untrue. And in addition, in our book, and I believe even in the film, there's evidence of debris on the lawn of the Pentagon. There's plenty of debris that's been found inside the building. There were the largest chunk was probably the landing gear that punched through the C-ring to make that 16-foot exit hole. So there's plenty of physical evidence, including the flight data recorder and forensics that were done, that there was a 757 that struck the Pentagon. And I'm still waiting, after 5 years, to see any physical evidence of any kind that would indicate that it was a missile or anything else that hit the Pentagon.
Well, I mean, we've been waiting 5 years to see clear video of what actually happened at the Pentagon, and you guys are coming on and saying that you're experts on the fact when nobody has seen what has happened. You guys claim to have seen photographs that have been released just to you, and I want to know why those haven't been released to the public.
What photographs have you seen?
I am not coming on this show and presenting myself as an expert in metallurgy or structural engineering. I'm coming on the show as the editor of this book. And what do? We do what you would do, Amy, or any other journalist would do. We talk to people who are experts in the field. And that's what we did with this book in order to debunk these 9/11 myths. I think I highly recommend it for documentary filmmakers or anybody else who wants to look at the data. That's what we did. We talked to people who were there at the scene, We talked to structural engineers. We talked to aviation crash experts.
Jason Berman.
Ms. Goodman, I would just like to address the fact that they have claimed that they have 84 videos through an FOIA request pertaining to what did strike the Pentagon. But the bottom line is, nothing should have struck the Pentagon. We know through the 9/11 Commission testimony that Norman Mineta, the head of the Transportation Department, was in a bunker with Cheney prior to the Pentagon strike. Now, this is the only 3.5 minutes out of the hundreds of hours that's been censored by C-SPAN. Why? Because he says he's in a bunker with Cheney, and an aide walks in and says, "Sir, the plane is 50 miles out. Sir, the plane is 30 miles out. Do the orders still stand?" Cheney snaps his head around and says, "Of course the orders still stand. By the time it was 10 miles out, it was too late, and the Pentagon was struck." That is a direct stand-down order. And if you listen to the NORAD tapes, later on, some of these people are actually tracking these planes, asking to shoot them down, and they're getting a negative shoot-down order. Why is that significant? Well, in June of 2001, Cheney signs a DOD memo putting shoot-down orders in his hands, Rumsfeld's hands, and Bush's hands alone, where it was standard operating procedure. If colonels were to intercept these planes and they saw a threat, they could do the shoot-down order.
Let's back up a little bit.
Jim Maddox of Popular
Mechanics. We started talking about physical evidence for an aircraft hitting the Pentagon. Then aircraft was seen by hundreds of people, eyewitnesses. The wreckage was removed from the Pentagon. The bodies were removed from the Pentagon and identified. None of those people have materialized to explain that this was a conspiracy. We're not a political magazine. We're about facts. We're about what happens when airplanes crash, how buildings are built. And so we're not going back to conspiracies that might have been hatched, you know, during the Kennedy administration or other eras. But we are looking for physical evidence, positive evidence for any of these claims. Every time we get into detail on one, they fall apart. The stand-down order is a good example. If you look at the NORAD tapes, and Vanity Fair, the same magazine that did a very laudatory story on you guys, has a story in their current issue that includes these tapes, and what you see was total chaos that day. Nobody knew where the planes were. It was complete disorganization, and the protocol for how to handle a commercial aircraft was off course, was a complete mess. And in fact, I think on September 10th, 2001, most of us would have been horrified to think that the minute a commercial aircraft goes off course, there'd be an F-16 on our trail with Sidewinder missiles. That was not a country I think any of us would want to live in.
What Mr. Meigs doesn't want to address is that article clearly states that the same kind of thing were happening in the drills as what was happening on September 11th. You have comments like, "I've never seen so much real-world stuff during an exercise." You have somebody following Flight 11 for 20 minutes after it's hit the World Trade Center. And then you have Cynthia McKinney twice asking for reports on these drills, the last time in a 2005 Department of Defense budget thing from Myers and Rumsfeld. And she never gets it. And she asks him, "Well, did these war games, you know, help or hurt us?" And Richard Myers actually said they helped our response on 9/11, which is total nonsense. We know at 8:45 in the morning, the CIA at the NRO building is running a drill of ramming a plane into a building. We know that FEMA was here the night before in New York City for a bioterror drill. We also know the FAA is running drills of 20-plus hijacked jets going in and out of radar at the same exact time these four hijackings are happening. That's what he doesn't want to tell you.
I also want to jump in. We still have not seen any pictures of two RB-211 engines, the tail section, any of that. We have not seen any significant parts of debris. And I would like to know what sources you have that the landing gear created that punch-out hole, because I have heard completely different responses. I heard the fuselage is what caused that hole.
There's a photo of it.
There's a photo of the landing gear causing that 16-foot hole.
There's, you know, one of the things that you can do, the Pentagon and a number of other engineering organizations did intensive studies of what happened to the building. The building is a reinforced concrete building. The aircraft was shredded into relatively small pieces. Some of the heavier components traveled farther, including the landing gear. You don't find an intact tail section when a large commercial aircraft hits a reinforced concrete building at 500 miles an hour. This is not a movie.
I do want to go to another clip of the movie, though, of the film. I want to turn to Loose Change, the part that does deal with the damage to the Pentagon. It begins with a clip of CNN's coverage on 9/11.
These photos were taken before the roof of the outer ring had collapsed. The only visible damage to the outer wall is a single hole, no more than 16 feet in diameter. A Boeing 757 is 155 feet long, 44 feet high, has a 124-foot wingspan, and and weighs almost 100 tons. Are we supposed to believe that it disappeared into this hole without leaving any wreckage on the outside? Why is there no damage from where the wings, or the vertical stabilizer, or the engines would have slammed into the building? Remember how big the engines were? If 6 tons of steel and titanium slammed into the Pentagon at 530 miles per hour, they would bury themselves inside the building, leaving 2 very distinct imprints. And yet, the only damage to the outer wall is this single hole, with no damage from where the engines would have hit. Why are the windows next to the hole completely intact? Why are the cable spools in front of the hole unmoved? As for the inside of the Pentagon, there's another hole, approximately 16 feet in diameter, found on the other side of the C-ring, 3 rings from the impact. For that hole to have been caused by Flight 77, the Boeing would have had to smash through 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, traveling 310 feet. The nose of a commercial airliner is composed of lightweight carbon. This is what usually happens to the nose of a commercial airliner in a plane crash. If the nose caused this hole, where's the rest of the debris from the plane? So, what could blow a 16-foot hole on the outer ring of the Pentagon, smash through 3 rings, 9 feet of steel-reinforced concrete, and leave another 16-foot hole? A 757? Or a cruise missile? This is what's
an excerpt of Loose Change. David Dunbar, executive editor of Popular Mechanics, your response.
We just looked at the physical evidence, and when the filmmakers can present some evidence of a cruise missile striking the Pentagon, we'll be happy to look at it and evaluate it and talk to our experts. Just rolling the tape back a bit, the angle that the film shows of the facade of the Pentagon before it collapsed is a misleading picture. That gash in the E-ring was about 90 feet across.
No, it was not.
The wingspan of the plane was about 124 and change, not loose change, but that punched the hole into the building. And then the landing gear was more dense and heavier and continued on through a forest of columns to smash that exit ring. So when you see that nice round hole, that's the exit ring, and that's the exit hole in the C-ring punched by the landing gear. And the and Purdue University did a massive computer reenactment of the crash and the aftermath, and they worked with the American Society of Civil Engineers in preparation of their report, and it's conclusive that the plane did strike the Pentagon.
Dylan Aker.
The initial impact on the Pentagon was no more than 20 feet wide, and if you're telling me that that initial round impact hole on the facade of the Pentagon is 90 feet, then you're telling me that the two windows above it are 30 feet across.
And incidentally, about the windows, I'm glad you mentioned that. Those were recently replaced in the Pentagon as part of a whole renovation program designed specifically to be blast resistant after the explosions at the American embassies in East Africa.
Yeah, I found it very convenient that Hani Hanjour decided to choose that one particular section of the Pentagon to hit when he could have just dove straight right into the front door.
In the world of paranoid conspiracy theories,
there are no coincidences. You're not addressing the evidence.
I'd just like to say this. Jason, the first official version was this thing bounced off the lawn and hit it. And it would appear that it would have to because it's such a low-level hit. Okay, it didn't bounce off the lawn because there's no scratches on the lawn. On top of that, we actually interviewed the first person on the scene before the collapse, and he was on the lawn taking video of it for 12 minutes. His name is Bob Pugh, and it is no more than 16 to 20 foot hole. And we actually have one of the survivors who crawled out of that hole and said she saw no plane debris. Her name is April Gallup. Explain to me how a woman can come through a hole where a 757 has just impacted the building.
10 seconds, Jim Max.
Yes. We didn't fact check every detail of Loose Change, but what we did do was look at the broad cross section of conspiracy theories. There are photographs of the plane in the building of wreckage wrapped around reinforced concrete columns, and there is a map of the path of destruction that plane tore through that area.
We're going to go to a break. We want to get to the World Trade Center. We are talking with the editors of Popular Mechanics and the filmmakers who made the film Loose Change. Stay with us. Thank you. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to another theory put forward by the film Loose Change, is that the fire caused by the airplane crashes wasn't actually hot enough to melt steel and cause the twin towers at the World Trade Center to collapse.
Hyman Brown, civil engineering professor and the World Trade Center's construction manager. It was overdesigned to withstand almost anything, including hurricanes, high winds, bombings, and an airplane hitting it. Although the buildings were designed to withstand a 150-year storm and the impact of a Boeing 707, jet fuel burning at 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit weakened the steel. Kevin Ryan, Underwriters Laboratories, in a letter to Frank Gale of the National Institute of Standards and Technology. We know that the steel components were certified to ASTM E119. The time temperature curves for this standard require the samples to be exposed to temperatures around 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit for several hours, and as we all agree, the steel applied met those specifications. Additionally, I think we can all agree that even unfireproof steel will not melt until reaching red-hot temperatures of nearly 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Why Dr. Brown would imply that 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit would melt the high-grade steel used in those buildings makes no sense at all. This story just does not add up. If steel from those buildings did soften or melt, I'm sure we can all agree that this was certainly not due to jet fuel fires of any kind, let alone the briefly burning fires in those towers. Ryan's statements directly contradict statements from other experts claiming that 2,000-degree heat inside the World Trade Center caused the towers to collapse. As such, days after writing this letter, Kevin Ryan was fired from his position. Not even the experts agree with each other. So what else could have caused the Twin Towers and Building 7 to collapse?
10 o'clock Eastern Time this morning, just collapsing on itself.
The second building that was hit by the plane has just completely collapsed.
We have no idea what caused this.
Almost looks like one of those planned implosions.
As if a demolition team set off, when you see the old demolitions of these old buildings, it pulled it down on itself and it is not there anymore.
If you wish to bring anybody who's ever watched a building being demolished on purpose knows that if you're going to do this, you have to get at the under-infrastructure of a building and bring it down.
We heard another explosion, and I'm assuming that's the one that came from the lower level, since there were two, and I said,
right, because it was like 18 minutes apart.
Well, this is, the first explosion, then there was a second explosion in the same building. There were two explosions.
Okay.
Federal agencies that were down there do believe that there was some sort of explosive device somewhere else besides the planes hitting.
NBC's Pat Dawson is close to the scene of that attack. Pat?
Just moments ago, I spoke to the chief of safety for the New York City Fire Department, Chief Albert Turry. He received word of the possibility of a secondary device, that is another bomb going off. He tried to get his men out as quickly as he could, but he said that there was another explosion which took place. And then an hour after the first hit here, with the first crash that took place, he said, there was another explosion that took place in one of the towers here. He thinks that there were actually devices that were planted in the building. The second device, he speculates, was probably planted in the building.
An excerpt of the film Loose Change, and as we broadcast today, at this time in the live broadcast, it's the time of the first plane hitting the first tower of the World Trade Center. Jim Meggs, the editor-in-chief of Popular Mechanics, your response to this aspect
Change. Yeah, well, that clip is interesting. It's built largely around the testimony of a guy named Kevin Ryan from Underwriters Laboratories. In fact, it turns out his expertise was testing water. He wasn't involved in steel at all. This fact has been widely known, and yet for quite some time, and even a lot of other conspiracy theorists have backed away from that, and yet it's in the film, and it looks so convincing when you see it if you don't take the time to go back and do the background research. And if you notice, so many of the clips in that section come from the day of, the day after, and it ends, along the way, Dylan, you say something like, even the experts don't agree. In fact, the experts do agree. The collapse of the World Trade Center is the most intensively studied engineering failure in world history, and thousands of pages of reports, experts, some affiliated with various branches of government, major engineering schools. There's no indication in any of that work to support any of these ideas of demolition or anything like that. And the things that are cited tend to be experts who, on close investigation, turn out to have no expertise, or first impressions of people on the scene who, of course, heard all kinds of horrible noises and confusing, terrible things in the chaos of that day.
Jason Berman.
Well, real quick, I just want to jump in and say that Kevin Ryan has been open about his statement. He's always been public about the fact that he worked for the, I don't remember the exact name, but it was a subdivision of Underwriters Laboratories, which did water testing. But it was the fact that he got the word from his higher ups that they actually had certified the steel, and I mean, his science still adds up.
In fact, Underwriter Laboratory does not certify structural steel.
Okay.
I would disagree with that, but aside from the hundreds of witnesses' accounts of bombs going off in the building, I would just like to go to the official version. They're saying that the intense heat from the impact holes was so intense that it weakened the steel, causing it to do a pancake collapse on top of itself. This is simply a lie. We know 2 minutes before the first building, which was struck second and burned for less time, we had firefighters in the impact zone saying that they could knock down the fires with two hand lines. Now, I ask you, can human beings stand in 1500 degree temperature, 1200 degree temperature, 600 degree temperature? The answer is no, they cannot.
Jason, I think it's telling that every time you disagree with something, you call the people a liar.
I am not calling anybody a liar, sir. I'm calling you a liar because you are a liar. These people were not lying. They knew they could knock down this fire. They radioed down. They said they could knock it down with two hand lines. And literally less than 2 minutes later, the building imploded on itself. And what you won't see in the clip there, but you can see at cloosechange.com, again for free, are the isolated blast points 20, 40, and 60 floors below this supposed pancake collapse. And these are blast points. These are not pressure coming from air. And doubt me, because if you watch the first plane hitting the building, the only video of it, you actually see one of these blast points go off 20 stories above that impact, and they try to say that the building is blown out on the bottom level, first floor, right? First of all, the World Trade Center goes into the Port Authority. So why did it go 1,300 feet down the elevator shafts, decide to explode in the bottom level, leave no fire marks? I mean, it literally knocked off 15-foot panels marble and left no burn marks. Marble, when you put fire on it, begins to turn yellow and brown rapidly. Look at the video evidence.
Dylan Avery.
I would just like to quickly jump in and ask what your guys' explanation is for Willie Rodriguez's testimony that he heard, experienced, and his coworkers were actually burned by an explosion in the basement of the North Tower prior to the plane hitting. And this has been verified by at least 20 different eyewitnesses.
Jim Maggs of Papa Mechanics.
When the plane struck the buildings, they penetrated the internal core. Jet fuel poured down stairwells and elevator shafts, setting off secondary explosions. Not to mention the horrific impact of these fully loaded planes hitting the structure and causing enormous swain. Give me a second to finish, Dylan. Okay. It's interesting. In that testimony, he says that somebody came out of the elevator area with his skin hanging off. That would be consistent with a fire, not an explosion. And you had a short clip of the Naudé brothers documentary about that day and of them entering the lobby, but what you didn't have was their voiceover where they saw humans on fire, which would be completely consistent with what we saw in all the reports on this, that jet fuel came down the elevator shafts. People died. We're talking about real human beings here. You know, this wasn't a movie. Yeah. This isn't a parlor game.
We are talking about real human beings. We need to respect them with the truth, sir.
It's interesting to note, too, that
you still didn't address the fact that it was before.
Empire State Building crash back in 1945. That building's still standing. Why are the Twin Towers down? But what's interesting about that 1945 crash with a much smaller plane going at a much lower speed had a lot of similarities in terms of the fuel pouring down the elevator shafts and stairwells and, in fact, igniting fires in the lobby of the Empire State Building.
True or false? The claim is that this fuel knocked the fireproofing off all the steel, correct? That's the claim?
No, nobody's claiming it knocked it off all the steel. It knocked it off approximately 60,000 square feet.
The impact
of the plane.
Another line.
Dozing through the impact.
Now, we only
floors.
Have a few minutes, and I want to get to Building 7. Dylan
sure.
Avery, what is your thesis? What happened to Building 7?
Well, basically, this is one thing that a lot of people don't know about September 11th, myself included, until I started doing the research. At 5:20 p.m. on September 11th, World Trade Center Building 7, it was a 47-story steel frame skyscraper 300 feet to the north of the North Tower. At 5:20 p.m., this building collapses in under 7 seconds, completely into its own footprint, into a debris pile about 6 or 7 stories high. Now, it wasn't hit by a plane. It was hit by debris from the North Tower when it fell. But if you look at all the buildings surrounding the World Trade Center, and if you actually look at Building 5, which is right underneath both the Twin Towers, that building is engulfed in flames for hours after Building 7 even collapses. So we have all the buildings surrounding the Twin Towers heavily engulfed with debris, some engulfed in flames. We have World Trade Center Building 7, which has isolated fires on floors 7 and 12. It has smoke coming from its south face, and these guys claim that 25% of the building was scooped out. Even if 25% of the bottom of the building was scooped out, that still does not account for the building falling in perfect free fall.
And into, your thesis about what happened? What
it would have had to have been a controlled demolition. That's the only way to prove, that's the only way to explain what we saw with our own eyes, and any attempts to discredit that are just not scientifically sound.
You know, this is a wonderful example of how conspiracy theories work. Anytime there's a little bit of doubt, a little bit of area where we don't know everything, then the answer immediately is, well, someone must have blown it up. It's a form of argumentation that's also used by creationists. If they can find one little gap in the evolutionary record, they say, evolution's a hoax, or
Mr.
Holocaust
denial. With all due respect, these are two completely different things.
Holocaust denial works with very similar logic.
Oh my God, man.
But what we see here is one of our sources was Vincent Dunn, the retired deputy fire chief for the New York City Fire Department, who wrote the textbook, The Collapse of Burning Buildings. And what he explained is that the building was extremely unconventional. It had this giant Con Ed substation with enormous trusses carrying extraordinarily high loads, very vulnerable to fire and other kinds of damage. It was not a conventional skyscraper by a long shot. Those fires burned unfought for 7 hours, fed by diesel tanks that were in the building to fuel backup generators. And when those trusses ultimately failed, the building did collapse in its own footprint. That's what happens when a building's internal supports fail.
We only have about 1 minute, and we have to divide it. Can you respond to that point and make your larger point?
Go ahead, Vermes.
On top of everything you said, that's where everybody rushed to for the local government, okay? We have somebody who is on the 23rd floor, okay, working with the local government, being escorted by firefighters. He gets down to the 8th floor, huge explosion in Building 7, bomb goes off. Okay, this is his words, not mine. Why are there explosives in Building 7? On top of that, they've given 5 different reasons why it fell. They're trying to say generators. There was a big fuel tank. There's a 20-story thing scooped out of the building, all
they
of which
is false.
They
keep changing their explanations for why the building fell.
And I would say this. The 9/11 Commission report actually has the nerve and a footnote to say that it collapsed in 18 seconds. Look for yourself and time it. It's no more than 7 seconds.
And who do you believe blew up Building 7?
We don't want to try to implicate anybody. We're just trying to tell people to go out and research for themselves. But, I mean, you have to ask yourself, who could have possibly placed explosives inside World Trade Center Building 7 secretly without anyone noticing, and especially the Twin Towers?
Especially now, again, the CIA, the DOD, the Secret Service are all located
there. That building was a
there.
Government hotspot.
10 seconds.
Yeah. You know, conspiracies have a way of constantly expanding. You just listed a whole range of government agencies. Apparently the firefighters we talked to, we at Popular Mechanics, other journalists, our friend David Korn at The Nation is accused of being part of this massive cover-up. The fact is, there are always little details that don't always add up until you finish your research, but when you really dig down, every single one of these has a clear explanation. And if there's areas that don't, let's continue to dig. We should be skeptical, we should ask questions. By all means, we fully support the effort to get to the bottom of any remaining questions.
We're going to have to leave it there. David Dunbar and Jim Meggs of Popular Mechanics, and Jason Burmes and Dylan Avery of Loose Change. I want to thank you all for being with us. Encourage people to come out to Cooper Union tonight in New York for Voices of Resistance and Change, Democracy Now!'s 10th anniversary, Breaking the Sound Barrier. That does it for the show. Special thanks to Sharif Abdelkaddous. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.